You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Astronomers like me value asteroids for the clues they hold to the formation of our solar system. In popular culture, however, space rocks are often bad guys.
Now, we get hit all the time by rocks and meteors, some of them the size of cars, some no bigger than your hand. But this comet is larger than Mount Everest. It weighs 500 billion tons.
But asteroids may be getting a bum rap because they are, in fact, extremely valuable to everyone, not just astronomers.
Asteroids contain vast amounts of useful materials such as iron, precious metals, and maybe most important, water. In the face of fears about the finite resources on Earth, there is a seemingly infinite supply in space.
And asteroid mining has been presented as uncomplicated. You simply go to one of these orbiting rocks, dig up the resources you need, and bring them back to Earth. Well, that sounds great, but just how feasible is it? After all, asteroids typically reside more than 100 million miles away, and scientists say there may be unintended consequences of using this nearby resource. This is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute, and I'm Seth Shostak.
I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode of Skeptic Check, our regular look at critical thinking, we consider asteroid mining.
Let's begin by getting to know our neighborhood asteroids, those leftover pieces from the formation of the solar system. They typically range in size from 6 feet to 600 miles and are composed of the same stuff that makes up planets and moons.
Anything that's on the periodic table is found in almost every object out there in our solar system. The asteroids are solid objects. They have they're rocky, or they're icy, or they're metallic, or there's some combination of all three.
Because they're largely made up of this primordial material, asteroids can provide clues about the formation and composition of planets, and even about the origins of life, as we'll hear later in the show.
So asteroids are the darlings of some astronomers and planetary scientists, but they are also increasingly attracting the attention of would-be space prospectors who see them as an orbiting motherlode.
If we think about the resources of the solar system that we can get to in any plausible way, then by far, by factors of millions, most of those resources lie in the asteroids, especially in the main belt of asteroids between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter.
Asteroids found in the asteroid belt pirouette around the Sun, somewhat slower than the Earth does, but about 3 to 4 times faster than the speed of the International Space Station. That means they clock in between 38,000 and 55,000 miles an hour, depending on their orbit. Something to be taken into consideration when we imagine mining them. And where did this idea of mining asteroids come from anyway? And why is it getting more traction now?
Well, Seth, I think you're in the best position to answer this because asteroid mining isn't a new idea at all, is it?
Well, no, not terribly much. I have to say, when I was a kid and I got interested in space, I remember reading, you know, stories about our future in space when I was 14 and 15. You know, back then, it was sort of received wisdom. It was the general assumption that we could venture into space and get the raw materials we needed to build whatever technology we're going to build, space stations or whatever, by mining the asteroid. So that idea is pretty old.
It sounds, though, that that idea was confined to science fiction until more recently.
Well, we haven't actually mined any asteroids, and in that sense, it's only been in science fiction, true. I think that the idea of mining the asteroids, in fact, derives in large measure from our experience in going to the moon and back. Because, you know, we brought back rocks. We brought back, like, I don't know, 300 pounds of rocks from the moon. And, of course, there's valuable stuff in those rocks because all the ores that you find on Earth, you can also find them, you know, in moon rocks. So the idea that there was something up there that we would want to mine became, you know, verified.
And I think, Seth, that the other thing that changed our relationship to asteroids, if you will, is we didn't know much about their composition until recently. Now we've had some missions that have actually gone to asteroids, and we have learned that they are rich in metals.
Yeah, well, it's true that we didn't know too much about what asteroids were made of. Keep in mind, asteroids were a discovery of the 19th century. Their name, asteroid, just means small star. And that's what they looked like to the early astronomers, or at least the astronomers of the 19th century. They were just points of light in the sky, like little stars. And that's why they got the name asteroids. And, of course, you could say that, well, you know, scientists sort of speculated with justification that these were probably, you know, made of the same sort of stuff that just about everything else in the solar system is made of, including the moons and planets, right? Because what else are they going to be made of? And but now we know that that's true because we've actually had missions that have returned stuff from the asteroids.
And then as we were learning more about asteroids, our own need for resources, in particular rare earth metals such as platinum for clean technology, has soared. And so mining companies began eyeing asteroids with more serious interest.
Well, it's true. Rare earth metals and other materials that you find in asteroids actually are necessary for the kind of technologies we're trying to develop. That is, you know, things like solar power, for example. You know, to make the solar cells you need for that in a big way, you're going to need some of these rather exotic elements. And yeah, you can dig them out of the ground, but they're in much higher concentration in some of the asteroids. So there have been sample returns from asteroids. The Japanese became the first, if you will, Earthlings, to land a craft on an asteroid, collect a bit of it, and return it to Earth. That was the Hayabusa mission, and, you know, really rather remarkable when you think about what was involved. I mean, not only did you have to get a rocket to this asteroid, but it also had to have, you know, sort of a robotic scoop apparatus to dig up some of the asteroid and then fly it back to the Earth and somehow get it back down onto Earth where scientists could look at it.
Well, maybe then all more remarkable was the recent success of NASA's mission OSIRIS-REx to the asteroid Bennu. It launched in 2016, it touched down on the asteroid in 2020, and it returned its sample from that asteroid very recently in the fall of 2023. Now, in the case there, Seth, the mission was to help scientists learn more about the solar system and to understand the asteroids that could potentially impact Earth in the future. But the success of this mission provided further proof of concept for private companies who want to go to the asteroids for, we can say, non-scientific missions.
So asteroid mining sounds like a pretty promising idea. And after all, both the Japanese and the Americans have done something along those lines. But, you know, it's not easy because you've got to first get to the asteroid. That to begin with is not trivial. The asteroids are all doing their own thing and you got to catch up with them. And then you have to somehow dig up what you want and you got to bring it back to Earth. So this is all pretty challenging even for the space agencies. And, you know, the NASA OSIRIS-REx mission, which is the one that's perhaps most relevant to this in terms of what's been done in the past, it took 7 years from launch to return of the materials it picked up.
Now, we do know how to mine. We've been doing it for thousands of years on Earth, and so we have plenty of experience digging and blasting through deserts or mountains to extract minerals.
However, asteroids have only a fraction of the gravity of Earth. Also, from a composition standpoint, they're entirely different beasts.
I'm Jim Bell, and I'm a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. Even the largest asteroids, the gravity is very low, 1/50th to 1/100th of Earth's gravity. And the small asteroids, like several that NASA and other space agencies have encountered with spacecraft, you're talking about 1/10,000th of Earth's gravity. So walking around, it wouldn't be very hard to launch yourself into orbit because the gravity is so low.
If you did have the gravity boots, though, and let's say you could keep yourself, you know, firmly tethered to the asteroid, would it be like icy and sort of slick, could we imagine? Or would it be like walking over a gravel? Or would you be kind of climbing up and down, sort of like rock climbing or something?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you know there's no such thing as gravity boots, right? You know that that's science fiction, right? Okay. But we could pretend. The answer is all of the above. Some asteroids are like boulders, like solid rock surfaces, maybe some little pebbles and stuff on the surface, but just monolithic hunks of rock. Others are what astronomers call rubble piles. Imagine a bunch of boulders all stuck together and smaller rocks stuck together. And many of them, the bouldery ones and the rubble pile ones, have soil, in quotes, soil on them, or regolith is the technical word for soil in my community. Very fine-grained, very powdery, and in some places can be very thick. Like when the NASA OSIRIS-REx mission sampled the small asteroid Bennu and stuck its sampling device onto the surface, it just kept going down and down and down. It looked like a solid surface, but apparently it was very fluffy. And they had programmed, luckily, the spacecraft to just go a certain depth and then fire its engine and come back. Otherwise, it'd still go. It'd be buried. But it wasn't at all obvious from looking at that picture how fluffy and loose it was. Very low gravity, just barely holding stuff together.
Let's talk about asteroid mining, but I do want to just follow up on this just because it's fun. Why aren't there such a thing as gravity boots?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, we can't recreate gravity because fundamentally we don't know what's happening at the subatomic level to create gravity, right? So someday in the future, when the physicists understand that and understand the fundamental origin of magnetism and things like that, then maybe those things will be reality. But we don't know how to manipulate that yet.
Well, manipulating gravity is a pretty common trope in sci-fi, and a prime example are what you were just talking about, gravity boots, although gravity makes its presence known in other ways.
There's a gravity field out there.
Gravity at 225 and rising.
Captain, we're in the path of an unidentified object moving toward us at high speed.
Profile suggests an asteroid, ma'am.
But let's say more about the role of gravity in all of this, because it presents a considerable challenge for mining companies to overcome. After all, they can't rely on the mining methods used on Earth.
Most of mining on the Earth relies extremely heavily on gravity and the fact that we have one Earth's worth of gravity to sort materials, create holes in the ground, things, you know, slump and fracture. And gravity is hugely involved in mining. And so a lot of the equipment, a lot of the methods, a lot of the what's been tried and true, it won't work on asteroids. So if you try to blast, it's all going to blast into orbit or beyond, out of orbit of the asteroid, right? You lose all that material. And if you're on a low enough gravity and you have a backhoe and you dig into it, you know, the backhoe is going to launch itself, equal and opposite reaction, right? Isaac Newton works on asteroids just like he does on the Earth. And so this is why I say there's a lot of work to do to figure out how to, since we don't have gravity boots, how do you anchor yourself onto the surface of a small body with low gravity? It's even an issue for the moon at 1/6 the gravity. The forces are very different, so it won't be directly comparable.
Another reason mining space rocks is tricky, asteroids are often spinning or just moving around chaotically.
I'm Martin Elvis. I'm an astrophysicist working on supermassive black holes and quasars, but also on space resources. The first thing you do is you have to approach your asteroid, and it's probably spinning or tumbling. If it's spinning, you can go to its pole and land and sort of make contact with it there, and you just rotate your spacecraft. Many of them are actually tumbling. They don't have a regular kind of rotation, and that's much more tricky. So it might be, in fact, that you just leave those out and just concentrate on the simple rotating ones, and that reduces the number of usable asteroids. Then you've got to land on the asteroid, or you don't really land because the gravity of the asteroid is tiny. So you kind of dock with it. Attaching to it is tricky because it's probably made of rubble, and you can attach to a boulder and you try to push away and the boulder will come off with you and you haven't attached the asteroid at all. So that's going to be just difficult.
Now, the first step is not mining. Now, the first step is prospecting, right? You get the you know, the salty old prospector. Ooh, Stinky Pete, you know, that guy, you know, and that's where it starts. And prospecting for gold is probably what most people have heard of, right? People go and pan in the rivers and that kind of stuff. But even looking for oil and gas deposits and mineral deposits, which is where most of the economic action is in mining, oil and gas, that requires prospecting. That requires a lot of remote sensing, a lot of ground penetrating radar and geologic mapping and professional geologists crawling all over the place and looking for telltale clues that if I can convince a company to sink a hole here for $1 million, they're going to reap $100 million out of that hole eventually, right? And the company has to think to itself, how many holes at $1 million each can I possibly put down before we hit that big one? And, you know, it's a cost benefits thing and all that, but it's prospecting that dominates the amount of time to find these mineral deposits. And then you find them and then they're exploited in a variety of ways. And that's on the Earth, right? Where we have infinite access to the places we want to go compared to out there in space, partly because it's hard to make those observations of places out there. It's hard to find those resources in convincing ways. We don't have access to those places like we do our own planet. So a lot of the tools and methods that are traditional and long proven to be useful in mining on the Earth just won't work. So in that sense, I don't think we need to worry about if there's going to be a rush. It's going to take a long, long time to go from prospecting to mining.
So, Seth, what we've heard so far are a few of the reasons why the physical nature of asteroids makes them difficult targets for mining.
Yeah, indeed. And it's mostly because they're just, you know, doing their own thing, moving around in a very unpredictable manner.
You could say that about a lot of people, too.
Yes, it would be true. I mean, it's like, I don't know, diving off a high diving board and trying to land in an inner tube in the pool that's moving around. That would be tough. So what we're learning is that mining an asteroid, it's just not like it is in science fiction. You can't just zip off to one and start digging with your backhoe. Of course, these problems can be solved. I mean, sending humans to the moon was just a thing of science fiction too, before NASA engineers figured it out. I expect that the engineering challenges of asteroid mining, they'll be solved in time too. For example, one of the ways that you might keep a rotating asteroid still so you could dig it up is just attach rockets to the asteroid. Take the spin out of it by having them blast in the other direction. Honestly, I mean, this isn't rocket science, except for the fact that it actually is.
But there are more than engineering challenges to consider. Coming up, some of the surprising unintended consequences of flooding the market with precious metals from space.
We're asteroid mining in this, our regular look at critical thinking, Skeptic Check on Big Picture Science.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
If we could overcome the difficulty of mining a spinning rock that's millions of miles away, Well, we could imagine the boon of having a huge supply of platinum, iron, nickel, and other elements, some of which are needed for clean technologies.
Some estimate that the value of precious metals in near-Earth asteroids is jaw-droppingly high. It is in the ballpark of quintillions of dollars. That's quintillions with 18 zeros. So that suggests the motivation of companies to undertake asteroid mining. And it also suggests we could build our renewable energy future on the materials from the asteroid belt.
So how do you pick the most mineable asteroids? Well, you begin with location. The nearest asteroids, also called near-Earth objects, are obviously most attractive for mining. There are about 20,000 of those. So far, researchers have only identified about a dozen that could be mined with current technology, although that number is expected to grow with further analysis.
Now, not all of those are chock full of desirable materials. Astrophysicist Martin Elvis points out that there are three types of asteroids, C for carbonaceous asteroids, S for silicate, and M for metallic.
So that crusty type is called carbonaceous, and they really are heavily, it's not just a little bit of carbon in it. I'm told that if you take a meteorite, which is a tiny fragment of one of these, and cut a slice off it and smell it, it smells like tar. I mean, this is seriously thick in these organic materials. The rocks are just rocks, silicate rocks, the kind you see anywhere. Yeah. And then the innermost part where the iron went leads to metallic asteroids. That's reflected in the population of meteorites that we find on the ground. You find all of these different types. Those are also subdivided in many complicated ways, but there are three basic types. And from a mining point of view, I think that's all that matters.
Like the prospectors of the 19th century panning for gold and tossing out rocks along the way, finding metallic asteroids is done through a process of elimination, beginning with eliminating stony asteroids, Dr. Elvis told Brian Edwards.
First, finding the asteroid that is pure metal is not that easy. It's easy to actually get rid of the stony ones because if you take a spectrum of them, and then around the reddest part of the spectral band, you see that it gets darker, and that's a sign of silicate rock absorption by a couple of different minerals. So you can throw those out, and that's good because that's 85% of them. So that really cleans things up. If you could tell that it was a very low reflectivity, low albedo, as we call it technically, rock, then that probably says it's carbonaceous. But if you're interested in platinum, that's not the rock for you. So now you're down to about 5% of all the rocks, asteroids, and that now you've got a good chance that those are metallic, but it's not guaranteed. But the next problem is, suppose you found one that is rich in platinum, palladium, and other things that indeed sell for like $50 million a ton, that sort of number. When we say rich, it's rich compared with even the best mines on Earth, but that's still a few ounces per ton. And so extracting an ounce of material from a ton means you've got to do an awful lot of work refining the material to just have the valuable mass to bring back. And you really, really want to do that in space because it's very hard to move mass around in space.
So I'm not lucky enough if I'm a space entrepreneur here to just go, you know, slice off a piece of asteroid and bring it back to Earth and refine it here. It sounds like we're going to have to be able to do that in space.
And not just in space, but at the asteroid's native orbit. So that's a long way away. It probably is as far away as the sun is from us. And it's got to do that automatically for months. So that's an engineering challenge for sure, right? It's not that it can't be done. It's just that we may or may not be ready for it. There are companies like Astroforge that think they're on the right path. And, good for them. I hope so. But the challenges are immense.
And I think I hear from a lot of different types of companies when they talk about these challenges, they give kind of 5 to 10 year estimates for being up and running and mining asteroids. Does that sound realistic to you?
The first part is prospecting, because you've got to have a good supply of asteroids that are worth going to convince your investors that this is a sensible thing to go after. Astroforge made a bit of a splash recently by saying they had one. They're not going to tell anyone which it is, but they're going to send a probe to it just to check it out. And that was an interesting moment in history, in that it's the first time really that intellectual property is being claimed in space, that you're not telling anyone about it is worth something, that by knowing which rocks to go to is itself worth a lot.
I was going to say, and that's the reason that there's a lot of secrecy right now around Astroforge and which asteroid they are looking at right now, is for that exact reason, correct?
So in some way or another, we're going to need more regulation of what you can do in outer space with respect to mineral rights and probably other things too. There are two big surveys coming up, and they're motivated by trying to stop any rock coming and hitting the Earth and wiping us out like the dinosaurs were wiped out. And the first of those is the Vera Rubin telescope, just coming to completion on a mountaintop in Chile. It's going to take pictures of the whole accessible sky every couple of nights, and it's going to do it in six different colors. And it will find many, many asteroids in there. You'll have that clue that I mentioned, the little red dimming that will mark out the silicate rocks, and that will get rid of those. And so that will be a huge advance in terms of total numbers that we know about. And therefore, of those larger numbers, you'll be able to pick out the ones with the best orbits to go to, the easiest to reach. And of those, you can pick out the ones that are not silicate rock. So you'll be really way ahead. I would think that 5 years from now, there'll be a good supply of those. About that time, there'll be a second survey going up, which is a completely different principle. It's a NASA mission called the NEO Surveyor, Near Earth Object Surveyor, to look in the infrared where these objects glow from their black body radiation. Just by being warm, they glow. It'll pick out the dark asteroids particularly well because they absorb all that light until they get warmer and they re-emit. And if you don't see something in the Rubin telescope and you do see it in the NEO Surveyor, then it's very, very likely to be a dark carbonaceous asteroid. And so what's left over from all of that, you're going to get a good set of highly likely metallic asteroids.
So it does sound like we will, you know, whether we will be at an asteroid and mining in 5 to 10 years, who knows, maybe. But it does sound like along that time frame, we will have a very good map.
It's not a crazy time scale. I think it's a little optimistic. But of course, in parallel, the companies are going to practice their in detail assaying methods and then their refining methods. And so maybe the two will converge 10 years from now and or even 5 years from now, and we'll be able to at least begin small quantities. Of course, we talk about small quantities now because that's all we can get. But with the rush of new large rockets, notably the SpaceX Starship, but also New Glenn from Blue Origin, for instance, the mass we can send out there, the biggest mining engine that we can send out there will grow quite a lot. And so the scale that we're used to working on may seem very small and feeble by 10 years from now.
Martin, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Okay, pleasure. Thank you very much.
Astrophysicist Martin Elvis talks rocks with assistant producer Brian Edwards. Well, the advocates of asteroid mining say that mining metals in space may be better than doing it on Earth because it gives us access to large untapped deposits and the environmental impact is lower. Well, it sounds promising, but there is still more to consider, such as the unintended consequences of bringing that material back to Earth.
Ian Lang is an economist at the Colorado School of Mines. We heard how valuable metallic asteroids are, but he says that it's what's inside the carbonaceous ones that's most essential for our spacefaring future.
Well, it's definitely water, right? Water for many reasons, either hydrogen as part of a fuel or water that, you know, humans need.
When you say water, I mean, I assume the idea there is that, well, we're not bringing the water back to the surface of the Earth. We're going to use it for our, you know, space colonies or whatever in the solar system, that sort of thing, right?
Correct. Yeah, water is pretty heavy. My colleagues tell me something about the tyranny of the rocket equation or something like that, that talks about how much, you know, fuel you need given a amount of weight to get away from the Earth's gravity. So anything you can find already in space will make your life much easier.
It currently costs about roughly $1,000 per pound to put something up into orbit around the Earth. Okay, so I'm going to use that as sort of an index of what it would cost to bring something into orbit from further out in the solar system. Why do we need a new source for these materials if we already have operating mines right down here on Earth?
Oh, I don't think we do need a new source of these materials. There's lots of minerals in the land, undersea, and out in outer space. And yes, we do expect mineral demands to increase, but for every mineral that I've seen an analysis of, we have, you know, hundreds, if not multiple hundreds of years in the Earth's crust. So, but people like space, and so, you know, people think it would be good to go to space. You know, if I were to argue from the point of view of an asteroid miner, right, so you could make an argument like the quality of the deposits in outer space are better than many of the quality of deposits on Earth, because we've spent millennium mining deposits on Earth, and we, in some sense, either started with really good ones or made sure we mine the really good ones, whereas nobody's mined the really good ones in outer space. Now, prices are falling for launches, and we're getting better at the technology in outer space. My colleagues at the Space Resources Program here at the Colorado School of Mines spend a lot of time trying to think about how to build a rover or move a rover or things like that. You know, and as those get better, right, eventually these costs might come into parity, but right now they aren't.
But at the moment, it's still cheaper to mine the stuff on Earth. Is that what you're saying?
And process, and yes, every aspect of it.
If you look at, you know, the contents of your average asteroid, right, there are a lot of precious metals in there, including something like gold, for example. Now, if suddenly you get this, you know, really inexpensively priced gold available from, you know, a couple of, I don't know, tens of millions of miles away from Earth, you know, that might kill the market, or at least, you know, the price of gold might bottom out, and that could have consequences too. Do people think about these things?
Yeah, I mean, terrestrial mining companies will certainly respond, right? And so if you were to bring, let's just take an example, some platinum group metals, because that's something people talk about a lot. If you were to bring 3 times annual production, say, of platinum group metals down to Earth at once from an asteroid, right? Terrestrial platinum miners would all of a sudden be like, whoops, or as they see some potential success of your project, they would just be like, we're closing up shop. Everybody's fired, right? Obviously, prices would fall. Now, what you might hope to happen is that other and potential uses of platinum see that reduced price and substitute some other metal out and platinum in. And so that, you know, in some sense, the price might rebound as, we'll say, the economy responds to this new reduced price of an important input.
And suppose we don't do this. Suppose we don't set up solar system mining or something to get these obvious candidates, you know, precious metals and so forth and so on. Suppose we don't. How does that affect the world 100 years from now?
Well, what it probably does is slow down any transition away from oil and gas. I mean, I would say geologically, we are not lacking for any of these minerals on the Earth's surface. We have hundreds of years of supply of most of the minerals that we would use in our economy. But what does happen is it raises their prices, and then it means when you go to the dealership and are thinking between an EV and an internal combustion engine, you say, wow, that EV's twice as much. I think I'll stick with the internal combustion engine. And as a result, governments around the world still allow permitting of oil and gas drilling, and we still have investment in gas and, you know, oil and gas infrastructure, and prices of those don't rise as much to make us think about substituting out. So I would say the largest impact would probably be just a slowdown in any movement towards electrifying the world economy, like is sort of hypothesized by things like the IPCC.
Ian Lang, thanks so very much for speaking with us.
Oh, I'm excited to have this conversation. Thank you.
Ian Lang on the economic consequences of bringing metals from space to Earth. Dr. Lang is an economist at the Colorado School of Mines.
There are a lot of things to consider as we plan to make the asteroid belt a resource, but here's another reason to get to know these rocks better. The composition of asteroids helps reveal the story of the birth of our solar system.
Many of which are thought to be very primitive, just formed from the cooling of that cloud of gas and dust that our whole solar system was formed from. And does our history on our planet give us the right to strip mine an asteroid.
Next, do we have an ethical obligation to leave the asteroids of our solar system alone?
We're mining for answers as well as asteroids in this episode of Skeptic Check on Big Picture Science.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
We've been talking a lot about what's inside asteroids, but there's one aspect of their contents that has nothing to do with mining. These rocks were created during the chaotic and poorly understood earliest era of the solar system, about 4.5 billion years ago.
Planetary scientist Jim Bell describes what the study of asteroids might reveal about the formation and composition of planets and even the origin of life. This raises ethical questions, such as, do we have any obligation to keep the asteroids intact? And is the scientific study of asteroids compatible with mining them?
Most of them, but not all of them, most of them are just the primitive remains of the cooling of the cloud of gas and dust from which our solar system formed. 99.9% of that gas and dust went into the sun. And of the 0.1% left over, 99% of that went into Jupiter. And of the 0.1% left over, it's all the rest of the planets and us.
So maybe it's like if you make a cake and you have all those crumbs that are left over on the counter that don't go into the cake, those are the asteroids?
Exactly. And if you imagine that you give the cake away and then somebody comes to your kitchen and says, oh, what kind of cake did you make? And what was that cake like? They're a skeptic and they don't want to just believe you, but they want some proof. Well, then you go scoop up the crumbs, right? And say, take these crumbs into your chemical analysis instrument and you'll find out that it's sugar and flour and some vanilla and whatever. And it's very similar, right? We see our planets. We see the result of solar system formation, the sun and the planets. But what are they like on the inside? What are they made of? What went into making them? All that's left is crumbs.
So let's move into some of the other reasons why asteroids are fascinating to scientists. Interesting in their own right, but they can also tell us something about the formation of planets. And could you just elaborate a bit more?
Yeah. And, you know, so again, all these different kinds of asteroids, many of which are thought to be very primitive, just formed from the cooling of that cloud of gas and dust that our whole solar system was formed from. And they crash into each other early in the history of the solar system. It was a much more violent place than it is now. And sometimes they crash into each other and break each other apart. Sometimes they crash and stick. And as they stick, the ones that stick, the small fraction grow bigger, they have more gravity, more stuff sticks to it. And it turns out they grow very rapidly. This has been simulated in computer models by astronomers and planetary scientists. They grow very rapidly into a relatively small number of big objects, which become the planets.
So when we were talking about the cake analogy earlier, I was imagining that planets form and then the asteroids are what are left over. But it also sounds like the asteroids can smash together. They could actually become the seed of a planet. Is it both, or am I understanding that correctly?
It is absolutely both. And the reason, the favorite hypothesis for why there are metallic asteroids and metallic meteorites in the world's meteorite collections is that some of these small bodies start to grow. They get big enough to get hot inside, and then they, what we call differentiate, they segregate. The heavy stuff sinks to the middle. The light stuff floats to the top. And they become little planets with core, mantle, and crust, like you learn in geology class about the Earth. But they're small. And then they crash into each other, because the early solar system, when this is all happening, is a much more violent place, because there's a lot more stuff flying around than there is today. They crash into each other. If a planet with a core, mantle, and crust crashes into another planet with core, mantle, and crust, pieces of core will go flying around. That's the metallic asteroids. Those are the metallic asteroids. Those are the metal meteorites.
And so is there a little piece of Earth, a little piece of early Earth floating around somewhere in the solar system?
There must be. There must be. There are pieces of Mars that have been delivered to Earth as asteroids. There are pieces of the Moon that have been delivered to Earth. There are probably pieces of the Earth on Venus. There are probably pieces of Mercury on the Earth. You know, the planets trade material throughout the history of the solar system. These impacts crash and create this spray of debris, and some of that debris leaves escape velocity. So, absolutely.
But our interest in asteroids is more than identifying, you know, the parent planet from which the asteroid was born. I get the feeling that the asteroids can also reveal something about the formation of planets. And can you give us an idea of what some of the big picture questions are that planetary scientists have, that they would ask an asteroid, if you will, about planetary formation?
Yeah, I'll give you two examples. One, where did Earth's water come from? Why do we have this big ocean on our planet? And, you know, did it come from the inside because the mantle, which is most of the Earth's volume, has a bunch of water in it and it's just slowly leaking out in volcanoes and steam vents and eventually formed enough to become the ocean? Or did it come from the outside? Comets, for example, icy asteroids crashing into the Earth, dumping a bunch of water on our planet over time. Well, you really need to know what the mantle is like to answer that question, or to try to answer that question. And the mantle is, again, most of the Earth. That comes from the objects that formed the Earth, most of which were relatively primitive asteroids. And so if you can go out and measure how much water is in the relatively primitive asteroids, then you can maybe say something about how much water is in the mantle. And this is one of the goals of the OSIRIS-REx mission, to visit a relatively primitive asteroid, get some samples, bring them back into the lab. And that just happened. They were brought back last September. They're circulating among labs around the world right now, and they are loaded with water. And organic molecules, by the way. Not life molecules, but the precursors, the complex precursors of amino acids and things like that. And so it's painting a picture of maybe our mantle really has a lot of water. Maybe the mantles of other planets have a lot of water as well. Maybe Venus had an early ocean. Maybe this is why we think Mars might have had a lot of water early in its history.
Okay, so you said there was a second big picture question.
Second big picture example I can give you is trying to understand how the cores form of terrestrial planets like the Earth. The Earth has a big iron nickel core, partially molten, rapidly rotating, creates a magnetic field on our planet. And despite what Jules Verne said we could do, we cannot journey to the center of the Earth. We can't go get samples of our core. We study it indirectly, right, through seismic waves and earthquakes and the rotation of our planet and things like that. But there are metal asteroids out there, and so we can go study them. And in fact, there's one anomalously big metal asteroid that's about the size of Massachusetts, and it's called Psyche. And it's the 16th asteroid that was discovered in the 19th century. It orbits between Mars and Jupiter. And telescopes and radar, it looks like it has a metallic surface. And it's so unique and so large that we think that maybe it's the lucky survivor of one of those collisions I was talking about, where it wasn't head on, but it was like grazing. So it just, these two objects, two big bodies graze each other. And at least one of them was segregated into core, mantle, and crust. And that grazing impact knocked off the crust and the mantle. but left the core behind. It's like a crazy scenario. How often could that happen? Computer modeler friends of mine say once or twice out of those billions of impacts can you get that lucky. But maybe we did. And so the hypothesis is this is a big remnant of a planetary core that we can actually go and visit, and that's what the Psyche mission, NASA's Psyche mission, is doing. We wrote a proposal here at Arizona State University to lead that mission. We've got instruments and cameras and spectrometers and magnetometer. We're going to go visit that hypothetical mini core of a planet to try to learn as much as we can about Earth's core, because we can't go directly to Earth's core.
We started this conversation with your lovely descriptions of what asteroids are and what they might tell us about the history of planets. Should we be using them at all as resources for continuing civilization into the indefinite future? I mean, is that what they should be used for?
Molly, it's a great question, and it really touches on the ethics of all of this, right? I mean, we, as a species, the human race does not have a good ethical record of resource extraction on our own planet. But we need resources to power the civilization that we've created. Does our history and our tradition give us the right to strip mine an asteroid or the moon or whatever? How do we even do that? Not even worrying about ethically, which is a whole other wonderful conversation, but sort of governmentally, legally, right? There's something called the Outer Space Treaty right now that many nations, including the United States, have signed up to from the 1960s that says nobody can own the moon or Mars or an asteroid. Now we're bumping up against that. What if a company wants to extract a resource? They don't own it. Does that mean they have carte blanche to go and, you know, dig into it and take things home from it or transport them? Nobody knows. So there's a lot tied up in this. You know, what is our responsibility to nature writ large across the solar system and beyond? What do we need versus what do we want?
Usually when we apply the word ethics, we're taking into consideration living systems. So you said nature, we're thinking about living beings. It may be humans or the non-human living world. How do ethics apply to the solar system? And I wonder if that suggests that we should respect a kind of integrity of these solar bodies.
Yeah, there's no specific answer to that question. It's a great question, great topic for discussion. Certainly, as far as we know, there are no indigenous populations, life forms on, you know, these little lumps of rock and metal and ice that we call the asteroids. Same on the moon, right? There's no life on the moon as far as we know. We don't even think it could exist, right? So it goes beyond just thinking about what might we be doing to living things, but also what might we be doing to inanimate objects that are going to affect people back here on the Earth, culturally, spiritually, mm-hmm. emotionally, et cetera.
Well, finally, are the goals mutually exclusive, or could they be compatible? That is, the scientific goals and the commercial goals. Could you both mine an asteroid and also treat it in a way that it provides you with a glimpse into our solar system's past? Can you do both?
Yes, I think you can. Look at Antarctica as a great example, right? Antarctica is a natural scientific treasure that is shared among many nations on our planet. The issue of resource extraction from Antarctica is starting to come up as people discover mineral deposits, and there's oil there, and there's liquid water deep underground that can be extracted for people to use and to live and things like that. And so we have examples of trying to solve these problems on our own planet, and we need to look to those examples, both successful cases and unsuccessful cases, to guide us in our future off planet.
Jim Bell, thank you so much for this fascinating and also very thoughtful discussion of asteroid mining and what we can learn from asteroids.
You're very welcome. It's great to be on the show, and I appreciate the really thoughtful conversation.
Jim Bell is a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University.
Now it's time for the big picture perspective in this episode. We've learned that mining asteroids presents challenges that are not reflected in science fiction. So Brian and Seth, what are your big picture perspectives in this show, including the ethical questions raised, you know, whether or not we should preserve asteroids for science, or perhaps the practical and financial benefits outweigh everything? Seth, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, look, I think this is like many things. There is, in fact, some financial incentive to, you know, grabbing some of those asteroids and using them for, I don't know, improving the economy, if you will, or to make products they otherwise couldn't make here on Earth. And I think we should do that. We always have done that. And I see no reason not to do it here. I mean, the universe is huge, and there are plenty of rocks out there. So we don't have to save every one of them in the interest of science.
Interesting. Coming from a scientist. Brian, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's hard not to see the ethical issues, I think, if we talk about the kind of unabashed running into space, grabbing as many asteroids as we can. But I do think that Seth is right. We live in a world where we are continuing to build new things. I'm here in Brooklyn. This is a big city. It is only getting bigger and fuller, and we're going to need more materials to do that. And so it's hard to argue against doing it outright, even if there are maybe some tricky things that we're going to have to deal with.
And while a lot of the story is uncertain, it's also speculative. What do we know for certain is going forward in this asteroid story?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things about what's happening right now is in the past, we've talked about asteroid mining and it's been largely conceptual. And while it still is, there are a couple efforts that Martin Elvis had mentioned with the Vera Rubin telescope and NASA's Near Earth Object Surveyor project, where we're attempting to map out the asteroids that are near Earth and what they are made out of. And that's a huge part of mining asteroids. It's the prospecting part. It's the panning for gold part of looking for resources on asteroids. And we are going to have a much deeper picture in the next 5 to 10 years of what types of resources are in space but near us.
This show was made possible thanks to the grounded experience of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that searches for life beyond Earth. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. Also, a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This Skeptic Check episode of Big Picture Science considered the feasibility of asteroid mining.
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. Trimberger.org.
Get ready to geek out. The Wired Science Podcast explores all the latest and greatest in science, everything from strange diseases and biological breakthroughs to interesting tech and mysteries in outer space. Listen to Wired Science today wherever you get your podcasts. That's Wired Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Tech moves fast, so keep pace with the Daily Crunch podcast from TechCrunch. With new episodes every day, this podcast will give you a quick overview on everything you need and should know about startups, new tech, regulations, and more. Listen to TechCrunch Daily Crunch now, wherever you get your podcasts. That's TechCrunch Daily Crunch, wherever you get your podcasts.